Welcome to the Opium Den. I'm your host, Daniel Williams. Well, this is our third broadcast of the Opium Den. And for all of you who tuned in last week, I'm glad you're coming back if you have. And for everybody that's joining me for the first time, welcome. As I mentioned, this is our third broadcast. Our second broadcast last Thursday was a very humbling experience. We had significant technical difficulties, and Dan Rodigal, my technical guru, worked pretty hard last Thursday night, but we went dead a couple of times, and then we had a tremendous amount of background noise, and the whole show was kind of shit. So we've got Dan's worked real hard the past week to correct all of our technical problems. We had to get a new sound card and swap out some cables and a couple of other things that I have absolutely no understanding of. But so we're up and ready, and I think we're going to make it through tonight without any technical problems. But if we do, you know, hang with us. We'll get them fixed, but we think we're in pretty good shape. So as I mentioned, this is our third broadcast. So I thought I would, let you know what the philosophy and what our thinking here is at the Opium Den. And there's a lot of drug policy reform groups out there, and, you know, Drug Policy Alliance, NORMAL, Students for Sensible Drug Policy. There are a number of good ones. So I'm not going to try to be anything like them, because they do a pretty good job of what they do. But the philosophy of the Opium Den is fairly simple, and it has just two parts. Primarily, our overview, or what we think is the best for drug policy, is that we here at the Opium Den advocate for the repeal of drug prohibition across the board. We think that's the best way to move for the drug policy debate to go. Now, we don't, that view isn't shared by many of the drug policy reform groups, but all of them pretty much believe that repealing drug prohibition is our end game. So that's our philosophy. We believe that drug prohibition should be repealed. But probably the most important aspect of the Opium Den is that we want to give a voice to everybody out there that likes to get high. And we think that there's probably 30, 40, maybe 50 million adults out there who get high on a fairly regular basis. And the overwhelming majority of them do so pretty responsibly. So we're taking the position for all of the responsible recreational drug users out there. No one is really speaking for them that I can find. You know, medical marijuana and marijuana in general seems to be the primary focus. But in that focus, not much is talked about the biggest group out there, and that's the people who do drugs responsibly. So the Opium Den wants to be a gathering place for all of you who get high and get high responsibly, and we want to be a voice for that group. We don't really see anyone out there taking that position to support all of the recreational drug users that, as I said, do so pretty responsibly. So that's primarily what we think here in the Opium Den. Let's work together to repeal drug prohibition. It's silly. It's gone on for way too long, but mostly we want to provide a community and a forum for all of you out there that like to get high, and we want to hear from you as well. You can send me an email at daniel@theopiumden.net. Send a comment or a question, and we'll try to read it on the air. We would really like, though, is if you would, send us an email, but include your phone number. And if you include your phone number, you've got a better chance of being acknowledged, and we'd like to give you a call and put you on the air. So again, send us an email at or send me an email, daniel@theopiumden.net. And do that. Include your phone number. We'll call and put you on the air, and you can have your say here inside the Opium Den. Now, America has a dirty little secret. And our dirty little secret is that we like to do drugs. We like to get high. Shouldn't be a secret, and I think it's becoming less of a secret as we go along. But we do like to get high. And a lot of people don't like to talk about that in drug policy reform, but we are the stalwarts. We are the individuals that all of the drug policy reform groups rely upon for donations to keep their good work going and volunteer time to man the phones and do volunteer work for all these drug policy groups. So they rely upon us quite a bit. And I think it's not unfair, but it would be nice if all of us who do drugs recreationally that don't do them strictly for medicinal purposes, it'd be kind of nice if we could be acknowledged by the drug policy reform groups and acknowledged for our money and our volunteering, and also just the fact that we are good citizens and we just happen to like to get high. So what I'd like to talk about tonight, we want to talk about marijuana, cannabis. I like to refer to it as cannabis. I don't like the name marijuana, but anyway, that seems to be the most commonly understood term. So we're going to talk about pot tonight, and we're also going to talk about the current state of drug policy reform. We're going to take a critical look at it tonight. We're going to talk about whether or not medical marijuana is the proper strategy to move the drug debate forward. So if you have any comments on that or want to ask a question again, send me an email, daniel@theopiumden.net. Include your phone number, and we'll be more than glad to give you a call and put you on the air. So marijuana, cannabis, ganja, weed, all the terms for it. I don't know how many people actually know the history of cannabis in our country, and I speak quite often on college campuses about drugs and drug policy reform, and I have found that a lot of people really don't know the actual history of marijuana. I keep calling it marijuana, but the history of cannabis in our country. Now, back in the early days, when America was new and the frontier was wide open and we were moving right along, we got our first taste of cannabis via the British. The British made these tonics, elixirs and tonics, and the primary ingredient in these patent medicines was marijuana. THC was an extract, and they were called patent medicines. So these patent medicines, they were very, very popular in America's early days. If you think back to some of the westerns that you'd see on TV, there would be some guy come in on his wagon, and he would sell these patent medicines. He was, kind of a snake oil salesman kind of guy. But most of these medicines that they were selling off their little truck were tinctures and elixirs with THC being the active ingredient. Now, they were quite popular. They were very popular in our early days, frontier days, if you want to call them. And the only thing was the ingredients weren't listed. So everybody was getting high, but not too many people knew why. But they were quite popular and sold very well. So the medicine show guys, they'd come into town, put somebody in the crowd to sing the virtues of a particular tonic, and he was the shill, and he would share in the profits of all the money that the medicine guy would make. So anyway, we enjoyed these tonics for a long time. But what most people don't know is that the very first time Americans smoked pot. Now, we've been taking these elixirs and tonics for, you know, decades, but we never really smoked it. And we didn't first smoke marijuana, didn't realize it could be smoked until 1876, a full 100 years after our country was formed. And this in 1876, there were the World Expo, which was a, you know, a pretty big deal back then. The World's Expo was held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the city of brotherly love. And it was held specifically in Philadelphia because it was the 100-year birthday of our Declaration of Independence. So it was, a, you know, the World's Expos, they were always pretty big deals, but this was an especially big deal because it was the 100th birthday of our Declaration of Independence. So it was a great celebration. And to honor such an historic event, the Sultan of Turkey invited everybody over to the Turkish Pavilion because he wanted to introduce us to a particular Turkish treat. And obviously that particular Turkish treat was the smoking of marijuana. So everybody went over to the tent, and the Sultan of Turkey graciously hosted the very first official pot party in the United States, and it was a celebration of freedom. So I think that's kind of an interesting, it's not trivia, but it's an interesting fact to know that when we first smoked marijuana, it was to celebrate freedom. And now here we are 230 some odd years later, and smoking marijuana has gone from being a toast of the town to being a high crime and misdemeanor. So it's important to keep that fact in mind, and it helps to understand the context of how marijuana smoking first came into play. Now, back you know, after the World's Expo, there was a pretty significant interest in now smoking this smoking cannabis marijuana. And obviously there were no laws against it, and because it was so popular at the expo, there were a number of smoking establishments that came into play, mostly in some of the bigger towns in the Northeast. But they were quite popular for a while, and people, you know, rich people, regular guy, you know, type of people, they all enjoyed it. But the interesting thing, And this kind of plays into the reefer madness idea. All of these smoking establishments eventually went out of business, and the reason they went out of business is that even though people enjoyed marijuana, it wasn't nearly the social lubricant that alcohol was. So there was a brief time in our history where you could walk into these smoking parlors and smoke hashish, smoke cannabis, and nobody went crazy, and nobody got arrested, and nobody killed anybody when they got high. So that's the initial beginning history of cannabis in this country. I think it's important to know that. So pot was still, after all of these smoking establishments went out of business or went bust, so to speak, there was still an interest in marijuana, and people continued to smoke it, and there was really no big deal. All that changed, of course, as many of you know, when the Great Depression, our first Great Depression, not that we're in one now, but the Great Depression of the 20s and 30s, when that came into play, we had some southern states who were very mad at the Mexican immigrants, because they were, the Mexican immigrants did all the menial jobs that the white guys didn't want to do. And nobody really cared much until the Great Depression, and then all the Americans, all the gringos, wanted the jobs that the Mexican immigrants excuse me, the Mexican immigrants were holding. So they wanted to figure out a way to, you know, basically pink slip all the Mexican immigrants. And there was a pretty clear line drawn between the intoxicants of choice, let's call it that. The Mexican immigrants mostly smoked marijuana in their recreational time after a hard day's work. They'd sit around, smoke pot, and relax. And the gringos, they drank. Now, again, alcohol had been prohibited. We were in the alcohol prohibition stage, but it was a pretty clear line between the two groups. So four southern states that were mostly affected by the immigrants and the jobs that they held petitioned the federal government to make marijuana, smoking, possession, whatever, all of that illegal. And the man they petitioned was Henry J. Anslinger, who was our first official drug czar in the United States. So at that point, at that time, those four states were petitioning Anslinger to make a federal law against marijuana. And Anslinger didn't really want to do this. He saw the impossibility there because, number one, this was a plant that grew wild every place in the world except the Arctic Circle. And he didn't know how he would be able to convince Congress to outlaw literally a weed. And plus, we had the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914, which prohibited narcotics, opium, cocaine, things of that nature. So he was busy. He was busy fighting on that front, and he told the four states that, you know, sorry, but you know, thanks, but no thanks, and I've got other things to do. So at that point, the southern states were upset with the federal government, but they decided to take things into their own hands, and they were aided greatly by William Randolph Hearst, and I think most people recognize that name. He was a newspaper publishing tycoon, and he was a classic xenophobe. And so William Randolph Hearst began in all of his tabloid newspapers. He created what he labeled the marijuana menace. And he spread all of these false stories throughout his tabloids about all these Mexicans, you know, south of the border down in Mexico. They would smoke this marijuana, and they'd go on these rampages where they would kill and rape and pillage and plunder. And obviously it was total shit, but that's what William Randolph Hearst wanted everybody to believe. And obviously there was a certain amount of people who did believe that. The marijuana menace was coming to a theater near you, so to speak. And William Randolph Hearst did his very best to exploit that and to exploit the ignorance of the American people and create all this animosity for the Mexican immigrants. So before the federal government would do anything, it would be sometime actually 1936, but Henry Anslinger and William Randolph Hearst, they worked on a strategy, and the idea was to have the states pass laws. So in the late 20s and early 30s, a number of states passed laws against the possession and use of marijuana. Now, the most infamous time was down in New Orleans in the late 20s. Marijuana was a very, you know, a pretty popular intoxicant for a lot of the people who played jazz music and the people who listened to jazz music. So down in New Orleans, jazz was, as a genre, was just beginning, and a lot of people enjoyed smoking marijuana and listening to jazz. So there was a little crime wave that swept across New Orleans and through the black community. It had nothing to do with marijuana, obviously, but William Randolph Hearst seized upon that and said that the crime wave was due to the black people smoking marijuana. And there were crazy shit stories about people smoking pot, where it helped develop larger size bullets, if you can imagine that, because rumor has it that when black people smoked pot, they became, so enraged and so powerful that regular bullets wouldn't kill them. So that was one offshoot of the marijuana hysteria back in New Orleans. So it was crazy, and New Orleans became one of the first states to prohibit marijuana. So the hysteria was there. It was primarily racial, and I just dropped the windscreen off my microphone. Sorry about that if you heard that. So as everyone knows, our drug laws came into play basically because of religious arrogance and racial bigotry. So Henry Anslinger was forced to make some type of federal effort to criminalize the possession and use of marijuana. But the problem was that constitutionally it was, something that he really couldn't do. And it was a pesky problem for old Henry. But he found his solution by looking at another law of the era. And there was a law passed by Congress to, and for all of you gun aficionados out there, this is a bit of interest. But there was a Machine Gun Act passed by Congress, and it was designed to essentially take machine guns off the market, because it was the preferred weapon of all of the of Al Capone and all of the Prohibition era gangsters. And essentially, the law said that you could not give away, sell, transfer, lend. In other words, change hands with a machine gun couldn't change hands unless you had a machine gun stamp, which allowed you to do whatever you wanted to do. Now, obviously, it was designed to take machine guns off the market, so the government didn't even make the stamp. You couldn't get one. It was a very naked attempt to ban machine guns. So it effectively, it was crazy logic, but the Supreme Court upheld that law, the Machine Gun Transfer Act. So when that happened, that was what inspired Henry J. Anslinger to come up with the Marijuana Tax Act. And the primary tenet of the Marijuana Tax Act was that you needed a marijuana tax stamp. If you wanted to grow, sell, consume, whatever associated with marijuana, you had to have this stamp. So, but the only way you could get the stamp, and this is the surreal part, the only way to get the stamp is if you showed up at the local office, and you had to have proof of your need. So you had to bring in marijuana to the local office to get your stamp. So when you showed up at the office with your marijuana in hand to apply for your stamp, you were arrested for the possession of marijuana without a stamp. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's exactly the way it was. So that effectively, put the kibosh on the marijuana business and was able to pass constitutional muster. So that was in 1936, Marijuana Tax Act with the marijuana tax stamp necessary. So the government, again, didn't even issue the stamps and could care less about it, and it was totally unconstitutional. But it took a while for that to be proven unconstitutional. And interesting bit of trivia, the way that came about, name that you might know, Timothy Leary. He was associated with LSD movement, turn on, tune in, and drop out. But Timothy Leary, in the early days, before everything got really crazy, when he was still working at Harvard and doing his psilocybin and LSD experiments with college students and criminals and things of that nature, he was arrested for marijuana and sentenced to 15 years in jail. to make a long story short, what Timothy Leary did, he fought his case all the way to the Supreme Court. And his pitch was this, that in order to get your stamp, you had to incriminate yourself with marijuana. And since our Constitution has a clause in there against self-incrimination, the Marijuana Tax Act was declared unconstitutional. And this was done in the Lyndon Johnson administration, the Supreme Court of the Lyndon Johnson administration. So say what you want about Timothy Leary, and a lot has been said about the man. And we've been talking about that in our Legends of LSD series of interviews and conversations. But Timothy Leary was the man who overturned the Marijuana Tax Act. So when Richard Nixon came to power in 1968, there were absolutely no federal prohibitions against the growing, selling, possessing, using of marijuana. And we all know that Tricky Dick was one paranoid motherfucker. So his primary job once he got into the White House in 68 was to devise laws not only against marijuana and LSD, but against every other drug on the market. So what he did, he consolidated 50 years of drug legislation that had been started by the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914. So he consolidated about 50 pieces of different drug legislation into the Controlled Substances Act. And everybody out there knows that the Controlled Substances Act has schedules, five schedules, and the drugs were placed in the schedule accordingly to their abuse factor, lack of medicinal value, blah, blah, blah. And the worst drugs were placed in Schedule One, which means they were highly addictive, had no medical benefit whatsoever. So LSD, all the hallucinogens, heroin, they were put in Schedule One, and Nixon put marijuana in Schedule One. So we were off to the races. Marijuana was a Schedule One drug. And an interesting side note to that, in Schedule Two, which was considered, a drug that was that had some redeeming value, we placed, and it is still there. Cocaine is a Schedule Two drug, so technically, our government believes that cocaine is a safer drug or a less addictive drug than marijuana. So. That obviously doesn't make any sense, but that is the technical the way that the scheduling is. Cocaine is a less addictive, more medicinally redeemable drug than marijuana. So that's where we are, and that's how our marijuana legislation came across or developed over the years. And since Nixon declared his war on drugs, we have had over 20 million Americans, mostly young, 20 million Americans have been arrested for the simple possession of marijuana. It's an outrage, obviously. We all know that, so we're not going to go down that road. But, it's interesting that Richard Nixon, the most disgraced president that we've ever had, he was the guy responsible for the drug war. So it would seem that... that's a pretty good place to start to repeal drug prohibition. Richard Nixon, disgraced president, usurped the Constitution, was a very dangerous man. Now, a lot of young people that I speak with think that George W. Bush is the worst president in our history, and I'm certainly not going to stand up for George W. Bush. But I will say this. I was of age back when Nixon was elected in 1968. I was 18 years old. I was paying a lot of attention not only to the drug war as it was coming on, but I was also very politically aware and active in following it. So we have Richard Nixon doing his magic back then. So 40 years later, we're in this mess. So I would think that it'd be pretty easy for the Republicans or for anyone to to pin this whole Donnybrook on Nixon and say it was a complete mistake and move forward. But marijuana seems to be the drug that that all the focus is on. And I think, you know, I don't particularly agree that it should be that way, but we're going to talk about marijuana as a drug policy instigator, so to speak. And most of the air and the ink and the like on drug policy lately has been given to medical marijuana. And it's my belief that medical marijuana is not the right strategy to move the drug policy debate forward. I mean, I don't want anybody to get me wrong. I think medical marijuana is a very important issue. I'm a full supporter. I believe in the efficacy of marijuana as a medicine. And I find it heartless that our federal government continues to deny this this proven medicine. But as a but as an issue to move the drug policy debate forward, I think it's a loser. And I wrote an article for a website called Opposing Views, and if you get a chance, you ought to check it out, opposingviews.com. And my my article took to task the strategy of medical marijuana, and I said it was the wrong issue to move the drug policy debate forward. And you would have thought that you know, there was a picture of me clubbing baby seals or something like that. The response that that I got, there were over I think 33 or 34 responses to my article, and almost every single one of them, like I said, you know, it was like I was clubbing baby seals. But the point remains, and the point that I made, actually, the point that I made was that, you know, I made a point, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I became very active in drug policy reform after I retired from the business world. I made it a point to meet and speak with all the leaders in drug policy reform, and almost to a person, they believed that repealing drug prohibition was the end game. That was the goal that everybody wanted to go for. And my my objection is that medical marijuana was not the right strategy to employ for that. Now I've taken some heat for that, but I'd like to explain why I believe that it's not the right strategy. And again, if anyone agrees with me or takes issue, please send me an email, daniel@theopiumden.net. Include your phone number and we'll call and put you on the air and you can tell us what you think. But this is the issue. Medical marijuana is the first state to pass medical marijuana laws was California, and that happened in 1996. And, you know, after that, or since it's been passed, we've had 12 other states put medical marijuana laws on their books. It's taken 13 years to get 13 states. It's averaging one state a year just for medical marijuana. And assuming that we can probably start getting maybe one or two and a half states on average over the next years, it's still going to be a couple of decades before medical marijuana becomes law of the land, if it were to be law of the land. So I don't really consider that a lot of progress. And again, you know, don't get me wrong, medical marijuana is great, but again, I don't think it's the issue to move things forward, especially since, you know, all these drug policy leaders believe that repealing drug prohibition is the thing. So, like I said, I made it a point to meet and speak with all of the leaders, and they're going to appear on the show. I've set up interviews with Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance and Jack Cole of LEAP, and we have Alan St. Pierre from Normal going to come on, Chris Crane from SSDP, Dan Barnath from MPP. So a lot of these leaders will be coming on the show, and we'll be talking about that the medical marijuana issue as a strategic way to move forward. So, but I respectfully disagree with them, and let me try to make my point a little better here. Whenever I would talk to these guys, I would say, look, you know, medical marijuana is an important issue, but Since you all believe that repealing drug prohibition is the end game, this is the question I have for you. I say, well, let's look down the road a bit, and let's say that that medical marijuana becomes the law of the land, and let's even assume that marijuana becomes the law of the land, medicinal, recreational, no distinction. We've got marijuana as a law of the land. So since they believe that repealing drug prohibition is the end game, my question to all of the to the leaders of drug policy, and it is a question that they have not been able to answer. I asked them, okay, let's assume that marijuana becomes law of the land. What drug will you champion next? What's next? What's our next move? Because if you believe that repealing drug prohibition is the final solution, the end game, once you get marijuana legalized, you have to move on. So what drug will you champion next? Will it be MDMA? Will it be LSD? Cocaine? What drug will you champion next? And they look at me like I'm, like I'm from fucking outer space, and the look on their face is almost like, they really hadn't thought that issue through. They're very, very focused on the marijuana aspect and really hadn't thought about what's next. So I've yet to have that question answered for me, and I'll be asking that question to Ethan Nadelman and Steph from ASA, and the people that we'll be having on the show. I mean, I'm not out to, antagonize them, but I think it's a legitimate question. If repealing drug prohibition is the end game and we get marijuana on the board, what drug will you champion next? And I think that they're going to be faced with a dilemma, because all of the prohibitionists have been beating us over the head saying that medical marijuana is the Trojan horse. We're trying to get this Trojan horse in to legalize all drugs. And I got to tell you, there's, they say a broken clock tells the correct time at least twice a day. And even though drug prohibitionists are an ideological and idiotic bunch of folks, they do get it right on occasion. And this is one occasion where they are right. Medical marijuana is the Trojan horse in the door toward full legalization. So, the problem I see it is that there's going to be a dilemma. If we get medical marijuana or marijuana as a law of the land, and then the drug policy reform groups move forward and on whatever drug they pick next, the problem is going to be that the prohibitionists will, in righteous indignation will say, aha, see, I told you so. Marijuana was the Trojan horse. And fuck, they'll be right. So the dilemma for the marijuana advocates, medical or recreational, the dilemma is going to be when they get that law of the land, are they going to be forced to admit that indeed marijuana is a gateway drug towards not so much doing other drugs, but obviously a gateway drug towards legalizing all drugs. So they're going to be faced with that dilemma, and they either have to admit that publicly or that, well, yes, our strategy all along has been to repeal drug prohibition completely, and that we decided to use marijuana as our foot in the door or Trojan horse. And the prohibitionists are going to be right. So my question to the guys is, what are you going to do next if you have to admit that medical marijuana was a Trojan horse, swallow hard and move forward? Or because it'll be such a struggle to get this accomplished, will the people in drug policy reform, kind of retire and after their, would be obviously a very long march towards that goal, will they retire and write books about their qualified success, or will they fight on? So I think that's an important thing to consider when we look at medical marijuana and its advocacy and as a way to move the drug policy debate forward. And that was pretty much the gist of my piece for Opposing Views. And like I said, I received over 30 some odd comments, and all but one of them took me to task, thought I was cold-hearted and naive and trying to set back the movement. It was very I mean, it was very interesting to get those responses, but I'm not sure they read the goddamn article or read it all the way through, because I am not against medical marijuana. I think it's a great medicine. It's proven. I've met hundreds of medical marijuana patients, and there's just no question. I think the data is empirical, although most of it is anecdotal at this point, at least according to the federal government. But I see it as settled law in my mind that marijuana is great for medicine. So I didn't, I wasn't chastising the actual medicinal value of marijuana. I was just trying to talk about how important it is to amplify that clarion call for medicinal marijuana, amplify it and enlarge it to encompass the greatest good for the greatest number of individuals, and that's repealing drug prohibition across the board. So I took a pretty significant hit for that, but I stand by that. I think that if you think it through, as hard as it's going to be to get medical marijuana or just marijuana legalized across the board, the prohibitionists, when they do lose that battle, they're not going to go gently into the good night. They will erect roadblocks all along the way. So we have to think about that and maybe reprioritize how we approach the drug policy debate. Now, there's one group that I think very highly of. I think highly of all of them. I don't want to say that I don't, but I disagree with the majority. But there is one group that believes exactly as I do, at least an official group, and that's Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP. Now, I find it quite surreal that the folks that I find myself agreeing with most are the same people that have been hunting me down for 40 years, trying to throw me in jail for getting high. And they did. They succeeded back in 1971 and 1972 when I was a junior and senior, respectively, in college. So I was arrested twice in college. For first time was the simple possession of marijuana. And the second time I was arrested, I had we had about an ounce and a half of pot, six hits of very good LSD, a few orange sopers, which probably, unless you're, in your 50s, you have no idea what that drug is, but it was the precursor to Quaaludes. It was the very first Quaalude that came out on the market, orange sopers, made by a pharmaceutical company out of Illinois, Arner Stone. And they were 300 milligrams of methylquaalude, and, it was a great, it was the love drug. It was the very, very popular substance. So we were arrested with about an ounce and a half, six or seven hits acid and four or five orange sopers. And I had nine felony charges against me, and I was up for 2 to 10 years in prison. But anyway, I was able to, hundreds of thousands of other kids, I was able to beat the rap, as they say. And not only did I beat the rap, but I had the cases dismissed with prejudice. And what with prejudice means is that the court says, basically it all never really happened. Sorry, Mr. Williams, have a nice day. But, it fucked my life up for a couple of years. It created a tremendous amount of stress in my family, financial, emotional stress. And was not a good time. So here we have these guys that have been hunting me down and catching me on occasion for 40 years, all of a sudden believing that drug prohibition is wrong. So LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, great organization. Jack Cole will be on. I'll be having an interview with Jack Cole lined up. I'll have one with Peter Crist, Howard Wooldridge. So we're going to talk to everyone in drug policy reform and put him on our interview series. And I want to talk just a second about our interview series here. I'm trying to create a library of conversations with not only drug policy leaders, but other individuals that maybe a lot of people have not heard of. And my first, if you go to the archives on the homepage, you can click on my interview with Rick Doblin. I think a lot of you know who Rick is. He's the founder of MAPS, And we had a very, very, very stimulating conversation on pharmaceutical ecstasy. And I have an interview in the archives with a gentleman by the name of Nick Sand. And that name may ring a bell, but more than likely it does not. But Nick Sand is probably more responsible for the very best LSD ever produced, more so than for any other chemist. Obviously, he was good, and obviously Albert Hofmann, he devised it to begin with. But what Nick did, Nick was a very brilliant chemist, and he refined the process to the point where his LSD was significantly better than the LSD that was being produced by Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, which was the company that Albert Hofmann worked for in Switzerland when he discovered LSD. So Nick, he's a legendary chemist. He's in his late 60s now, but he's known for orange sunshine acid, and orange sunshine is still considered the best LSD ever made. So, and then he went on to produce, you know, more LSD, but he was arrested, went on the lam for 20 years, and all that can be heard in my interview with Nick Sand. So that's in the archives. Very interesting man, and I highly recommend that you download that interview and give it a listen. And I have an interview tomorrow morning, a conversation with Dieter Hagenbach, and Dieter is the he founded the Gaia Media group. Dieter's in his 60s, and he was a longtime friend of Albert Hofmann's. He knew Albert for over 30 years. They're close personal friends. So Dieter will be on the phone with me tomorrow, and we'll be talking about we're going to talk about Albert Hofmann the man more so than Albert Hofmann the legend. And I think you're going to enjoy that. Well, matter of fact, I know you're going to enjoy it, because it'll be the third time that I've called Dieter trying to get this interview conversation set up. Because the first time we called, we were Skype to Skype, and we had a lot of interference and noise. And then the second time we called, Dieter was gracious enough to take another call. The interview went great. You're going to want to hear what Dieter has to say. So, I pretty much know what he has to say. But the second interview, I will confess, I fucked up and I didn't do the most simple thing necessary to record an interview. I forgot to hit the record button. So, so Dieter has been very, very gracious and has decided that, or not decided, but he said that he would sit with me and get this interview right. So we'll be doing that tomorrow, and we'll get it posted up on the archives pretty soon. You're really going to want to listen. If you have any interest in hallucinogens and how Albert Hofmann dealt with all of his notoriety over discovering LSD, he was a very kind of a shy guy. He was a scientist. He was the complete opposite of Timothy Leary and how he approached LSD. So I think you're going to find that pretty interesting. So this is that's part of our Legends of LSD series. And later on tonight, possibly first thing in the morning, we'll have my interview that I conducted last evening with Martin Lee. And Martin Lee wrote a fascinating book called Acid Dreams, The CIA, LSD, and the 60s Rebellion. And what Martin did was doing research on another subject. Martin, a little backpedaling a little bit, he was the co-founder of FAIR, F-A-I-R, and that stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. So he's an activist, and he believes in fairness in reporting. So he's a very bright young man, and again, he wrote this book, Acid Dreams. And it talks about the CIA experiments with LSD as a mind control drug. And that interview will be up tomorrow, and I highly recommend that you download that as well. So that's kind of like how we're going to set the Opium Den up. Every Thursday I'll be talking live and hoping that I've got an audience out there and you're listening and you feel passionate enough to either agree with me, disagree with me, or just send in a comment with your phone number, and we'll put you on the air. So I kind of digressed a little bit there, but that's how we're setting up the Opium Den. I'll be live, every Thursday night, and you'll be able to not only download the live shows, but you'll be able to download all of these interviews that I have. So we're trying to build a library and get some of these people on the record and give you the opportunity to listen to them at your leisure. We have one other gentleman, actually two more, but I can only talk about one right now, in our Legends of LSD series. And we are talking with Richard Albert. And Richard Albert was Timothy Leary's partner at Harvard. And Richard Albert is now, goes by the name of Ram Dass. And so we're going to try hard to get Ram Dass on the show, and he'll add his insights to how things were back then. You know, close personal friend of Timothy Leary, instructor at Harvard. So Ram Dass now lives in Hawaii, so we're trying to work to get that. So I think the interview series is going to work out well. I hope everybody has an opportunity to listen and download and enjoy some information that certainly is not all that common knowledge. So like I said, we'll be talking to a lot of the people you know in drug policy, but we're also bringing in some folks that that can add a lot of context and information to how all of this kind of unfolded. I'm a big fan of hallucinogens, and I found that you know, when I talk on college campuses, there's still a high interest in psychedelics. So, for anyone out there who wants to know how LSD came around and some of the early deals, the good vibe, how the vibe went south, and the CIA and everybody's involvement, then those are some pretty good interviews. And so again, you know, if anyone takes issue with my belief that medical marijuana is the wrong strategy, you know, send me a note, send me an email, just don't send me a bomb, because again, I do believe that medical marijuana is very important. The efficacy is beyond doubt in my mind, but I just don't think it's the right strategy. And again, I'll give a shout out to Leap and Jack Cole and anyone who may be listening tonight from Leap and all of the organizations. I think you guys are on the right track. I know we need a lot of people coming at this from a lot of different angles, but God damn it, you know, it's been over 40 years since Nixon declared his war on drugs, and we've been getting our brains beat out ever since. So I think that my belief is that we should have a unified effort going against the government regulations on prohibition and just go flat out and advocate for the full repeal of drug prohibition. So that's where I stand there. And I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, 30, 40, maybe 50 million American adults get high on a regular basis and do so very responsibly. And that's the voice that I want to bring to the table and speak for everyone that for a variety of reasons are intimidated to speak up for themselves. And I certainly don't criticize anyone for that. People have jobs, they have families. The repercussions are unknown, and we're not going we can't expect you to stand up and make your position known. But there are those of us who want to do that. We don't have much to, well, I shouldn't say we don't have much to lose, because everybody has something to lose. But I'm retired. I have no problem speaking my mind. I wrote a book, The Naked Truth About Drugs, and pretty much exposes all of my drug history. And it's a pretty good book, actually. I'm going to give a shameless plug for my book, The Naked Truth About Drugs. There on my homepage on the website, you can click on the button underneath the icon of my book. It says Naked Truths. So if you click that button, it'll take you to a page where you can read the entire author's preface of my book. You can read that for free, download that, read it for free. And if you like it, we've decided to sell individual chapters for 99 cents each, kind of like an iTunes ripoff. But you can buy individual chapters. There's 13 chapters in total. Nine of them are all about drugs. Each individual drug gets its own chapter. So if you want to read, if you want to read about marijuana, if you want to read about MDMA, if you want to read about LSD and the psychedelics, barbiturates, cocaine, heroin, all of those drugs have their own individual chapter. So for 99 cents, you can download those. But please go and go and read the author's preface. The book did fairly well. It was pretty popular. I gave away thousands of copies and sold thousands of copies. And the reason we decided to go for the 99-cent ripoff of iTunes is that a lot of feedback I got from college students and young people that that I gave the book to or bought the book. Most of the feedback was, very positive. They liked the book and there was information they'd never known before. But I found that more and more people were saying, I really liked your book, but I really liked the chapter on LSD, or I really liked the chapter on MDMA. So I thought, well, what the hell? Instead of, selling the whole book for $20, which you can buy, I wanted to sell individual chapters for 99 cents. So Daddy needs a new pair of shoes, and we got to pay for all these sound cards and cables that we're putting together for this. So if you're so inclined and like what you read in the author's preface, buy a couple chapters. I think you'll find them very interesting. The book, when it was reviewed as everything from, everything from bullshit to brilliant. So we want to let you make that decision, and that's why we put the author's preface, which gives an overview of the book. And if you like that, then buy a couple chapters for 99 cents, and I think you'll like them. There's no encryption on them. They can be shared and sent around. And Dan Rodigal, my technical guru, told me that that's what you want to do. You want to give them up and let them be sent around. Don't encrypt them, because that's just going to piss people off, and plus they're going to figure out how to get around it anyway. So if you do buy a couple chapters, send them to a couple of friends, but I'm hoping that that will lead everyone to buy their own chapters. So again, marijuana. I gave kind of an abbreviated history of how marijuana came into use in our country, how the laws against it came into play, how the laws are still as surreal and Kafkaesque as it is. The laws are still against marijuana. And again, I'm hoping that I can get some feedback from listeners out there, whether they download this at a later date or are listening live. Let me know what you think about medical marijuana. Let me know if you think I'm off the mark on that, and that in essence I am clubbing baby seals. But I think if you give a thoughtful just spend some time thinking about it and thinking it through, I think more than a few of you will come to the same conclusion that I did, that medical marijuana is just not the right strategy for moving the drug debate forward. So I think we're getting close to the end of the hour. I want to thank everybody for stopping by and joining me here in the Opium Den. Again, take a listen to come back and bookmark the Opium Den and visit it. I try to blog every day, but mostly I'm hoping that you'll download these interviews, because these are with some people that you've probably never heard of, especially in the LSD portion, because many of our original visionaries like Nick Sand and Dieter Hagenbach, they're getting up there, and they're not going to be with us forever. And it's important to get the oral histories of how LSD came about. So come back and join and check out the website, bookmark it, check it out on every couple of days, see if I'm doing my part on putting blogs up, and check the archives out. So that pretty much takes us towards the end of our hour tonight. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and Hope I made some sense tonight, and we're going to try to make these as informative and enjoyable and different as you possibly can find them. So that takes care of us tonight. I want to thank you for coming inside the Opium Den. I hope that you'll join me next Thursday and visit and download some of those interviews. There's some pretty good shit in there. So thanks for joining the Opium Den with me tonight. This is Daniel Williams. Yeah, fuck. There it is.